Life of Gustavus Adolphus. Rudbeckius scolds the king. Among those who accompanied the army to Pskov and formed a regular member of the king's entourage was the court chaplain, Johannes Rudbeckius. He was himself the author of an extremely competent account of the siege of that strongly fortified town, illustrated by a sketch of its environment. It was the second time he had taken part in a campaign in the Russian frontier provinces. In his farewell sermon in 1620, Rudbeckius allowed his thoughts to range back over the hardships of his life in the king's service during these years. Quote, "At one time we would be forced to sit our horses all day in the rain and mud. In another we would go sledding through the snow in the bitter winter, though the weather was never allowed to interfere with the morning sermon. Sometimes we were at sea in the storm and the waters roaring. Sometimes on land, campaigning amidst the din of battle. Then the drum would sound, the gun would go off, and in the middle of a sermon, or while preparing one, we would hear the alarm and the order to mount." End of quote. His duties brought him both fatigue and anxiety. Once, after Gustav Adolphus's death, when calling these days to mind, he confessed, quote, how often I've wiped tears away from my cheeks because of the difficulties and the dangers that beset us. End of quote. Many of the sermons of Rudbeckius delivered before Gustavus Adolphus have been preserved. For the most part, he took his texts in a regular succession from 1 Samuel, which was admirably suited to the practical, clinching application beloved of the preacher. They swarm with contemporary allusions, these sermons, but they also express steadfast faith which does not shirk from giving utterance to its opinions. No court preacher could be less reserved than Rudbeckius in his exposition of the blessed rule of kings or happy government of peoples. His whole outlook was theocratic, but he holds that no one form of government is more acceptable to the Creator than another. Quote, "God does not desire that his holy congregation be bound to one form of government or one type of constitution, whether it be a king as sole representative or whether it be a committee of magnates or even a multitude of the common people." End of quote. In this interpretation of the Old Testament text, he often shows moderation, which derives from the inherent respect for equity and law. He is, however, clearly in favor of the polity based on natural law. Quote, "There can be no right or law," said significantly, "that is commanded by God and acceptable to him, which conflicts with the law of nature." End of quote. Yet at the same time, Rudbeckius affirms with flexible rigor the validity of a strict code of ethics imposed by religion upon the rulers of the nations. Their sins are visited as the scriptures bear witness upon the lands and the kingdoms. And the servants of the word must learn from the example of the prophet. They must not permit themselves, through smooth words or other means, to connive at evil and approve what is done amiss, but they must punish sin with rigor, having therein no respect for persons. This is a matter proper to their office and calling. That's a sermon from September of 1615. The intimate relations in which Rudbeckius stood to the king makes it probable that he knew soon enough what was happening. At all events, it must be considered as out of the question that he was still in ignorance of it after the burst of Gustav Gustafsson. The next sermon he delivered before the king seems, moreover, to point more clearly to this conclusion than any that had preceded it. It had to do with Saul's intended sentence of death upon his son Jonathan. Rudbeckius cited the popular proverb, quote, "Laws and ordinances are like a spider's web. It catches the little midges, but the big blue bottle fly right through it." End of quote. He held Saul's severity to be easily applicable, for the king of Israel realized that otherwise the people would say to themselves, quote, "If a common soldier had been at fault, he would have been condemned to death. But since the culprit was the king's son, it was glossed over." End of quote. The fault of which Gustav Adolphus had been guilty could, according to the ancient national custom, be punished in certain circumstances with death. A royal ordinance promulgated in the summer of 1615 had allowed the new high court to commute the punishment for such breaches of the sixth commandment, but within Duke Johann's duchy of Ostergotland, the old severe penalties were still in force. Gustav Adolphus had put himself in a difficult position in regard to his spiritual advisor, and also to all the section of society, the church, which he represented. It was not until 1617 that a final settlement was reached. The occasion was the proclamation of a general fast for June the 20th. Rudbeckius then presented himself to the king, and in private addressed him an earnest warning and exhortation. His speech happens to be preserved, and it is incontestably a valuable contribution to posterity's knowledge of the forces which contributed to the shaping of Gustavus Adolphus's character. It gives us a glimpse into the 17th century Swedish church in one of the most dominant moods, pitiless in its demand for a complete accord between life and doctrine. Rudbeckius observed that while he did not doubt the king's penance, he feared he had not fully appreciated how deeply he had offended God by his illicit passion. He had given an evil example to his servants and his subjects, and was even now tempted to connive at sin and immorality instead of punishing them boldly. He had forgotten the provinces of that God had manifested upon him in his youth, no small stain upon the honorable reputation, which in many ways he had acquired. It was not only earnest self-improvement and sincere prayer that he needed now, though indeed they were of the utmost importance. He must also, said Rudbeckius with emphasis, bring himself without delay into the lawful Christian marriage, and he must banish from his presence such persons of light morals as would not shirk from leading him to perdition, provided that their bread was well buttered thereby. It is arguable that we have here a fair picture of social conditions in the age when the zealots of the church doctrine didn't stickle at any obstacle in their inquisition in the private life. But even then, such a scene was very unusual. The intervention of Rudbeckius takes on a tinge of greatness from his vibrant anxiety lest the king fail in his mission. To that mission were attached the duties as husband and father, an obligation to continue the royal line for future welfare of the fatherland. Hence the typically Lutheran conclusion, the demand that the king shall marry is made in the name of religion. There can be no doubt that Gustavus Adolphus responded in the spirit upon which Rudbeckius had counted, for the king very soon appointed him to supervise his son's education, a token of confidence of which no other explanation is possible. And we shall see presently at the time of Rudbeckius' visit, Gustavus Adolphus was in a position of giving him reassuring news regarding worshipful exhortation, which had formed the last point in his speech, the question of marriage. Margareta Slots played so fleeting a part in Gustavus Adolphus's life that it may well be questioned whether she ever meant anything to him at all. Possibly other women, quite apart from Ebba Brahe, may have made a deeper impression on the young king. Two love poems have been preserved, one in Swedish, the other in German, which have been attributed to Gustavus Adolphus. They are certainly instinct with passionate emotion. The initial letters of the lines form the name Christina Fleming. There was in actual fact about this time a young woman by the name of Christina or Kirstine Fleming, the daughter of a Finnish nobleman. Nothing is known of her earlier history. That Gustavus Adolphus wrote these full-blooded erotic stanzas cannot indeed be positively proved, but still less can it be disproved. Certainly contemporary writers credited him with their composition. There is some reason to believe that the poems, the Christina Fleming, date from the period of the king's residence in Finland at the beginning of 1616. Zacharias Topelius, Finnish novelist, based one of his stories on this theme. A somewhat similar motif, but in this case a purely imaginary one, is of course the basis for the first part of the same author's Tales of an Army Surgeon. So what we have is Rudbeckius basically urging Gustavus Adolphus to choose a queen. Well, I think that's going to happen next time. The sources for this are Gustavus Adolphus versus Wallenstein by Pike, Gustav Adolphus, Sweden and the 30 Years' War, 1630-32, by Volk, The Lion of the North by Henty, Gustav Adolphus the Great by Onlund, and Gustav Adolphus and the Rise of Sweden by Roberts, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 1, Infantry, by Brzezinski, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 2, Cavalry, by Brzezinski. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.